Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit. Bandwidth for the Tech Guy is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com.
Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and this is my Tech Guy podcast. This show originally aired on the Premier Radio Networks on Saturday, December 22nd, 2012. This is episode 937. Enjoy. Well, hey, 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 how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the Tech Guy, and it's time for our holiday edition of the Tech Guy Show, which is exactly like our editions every other day of the year. 8888 Ask Leo, well, I guess one thing that might be a little bit different, perhaps you're thinking about some holiday shopping. I asked on Twitter yesterday for some suggestions for holiday gifts under $100, and we'll be taking a look at some of those tweets, some of the suggestions people gave me. Some very good ones, actually. I liked it. We can also talk about larger amounts. 8888-ASK-LEO is the number. If you want to call or ask a question, make a comment, make a suggestion. We'll also have the notes up on the website. We have a very good gift idea right now, gift guide right now at techguylabs.com, full of stuff I've talked about in the past. And some under $100, of course, there are a lot of things like iPad cases and iPhone cases and so forth. But there's more than that. There's some stuff that actually is pretty cool. A lot of people on the Twitter said a Roku box would be a good idea. Interesting. 8888-ASK-LEO, that's the phone number. 888-827-5536, toll-free from anywhere in the U.S., outside the U.S. Use Skype or some other voice over internet protocol and make a call to the 800 number. It's toll free. 8888 Ask Leo. Website again, techguylabs.com. Well, of course, the big story over the week was the Instagram kerfuffle. Did you follow all of that? Very interesting. It's a Facebook in the news, all over the news this week, actually. One of the things that happened was Facebook's iPhone and Android app, Instagram. That's you've used it, it's a photo app. The kids love it. It's kind of the Twitter for photos. Same idea, which is you take a picture, and by default, it's public. Anybody can see it. They can follow you just as they would follow you on Twitter. And just as on Twitter, you can make your pictures private. People can ask permission to follow you. The pictures, you can add a caption, people can like them. And the thing I think that put Instagram on the map, the thing that attracted us right away, when I started playing with it, when I say us, my friends, were the filters. You can take a pretty dull picture on Instagram and bring it to life with a simple filter. Professionals, I think, often mock Instagram for that reason. You know, it makes your photos look artsy, even if they're not. But it certainly caught on, lots of users. And earlier this year, it was one of the big stories of the year, in fact. Facebook bought Instagram for $1 billion. This is $1 billion for an iPhone app. It was only iPhone at the time, that didn't even have any revenue. As it turns out, that's how it works in Silicon Valley and startups. If you have revenue, that hurts you. I'm not. You think I'm joking? I'm not. Because if you have revenue, then your value, your worth is some multiple of the revenue, you know, 5 times revenue or 10 times revenue. But if you don't have any revenue at all, the sky's the limit. People will make up what you're worth. See, if you had to pay Instagram a multiple of revenue, and they were successful, they made $50 million or $100 million, it'd be pretty hard to get to a billion. Maybe if they had made $100 million in 1 year. But that's pretty unlikely. You know, it'd be more like $5 million, $10 million. Then how do you get to $1 billion? You don't. They make zero? Hey, $1 billion, no big deal. So Facebook has, you know, after Facebook bought Instagram, its founder, and by the way, when they bought it, I think there were only five people working there. It was a small little company. Its founder, Kevin Systrom, said, Facebook will not change us. Instagram is going to stay independent. And so far, it pretty much has, except they changed their terms of service this week, and people were up in arms because it looked like they were kind of moving in a Facebook model. CNET said, Instagram asserts right to sell your photos. You know, the photos you take with your iPhone and put on Instagram. That scared people. And then others said, myself included, Instagram announces it's going to use your photos for advertising. By the way, exactly as Facebook does. Have you ever noticed that on Facebook that, you know, your friends like, caramel corn. And it's an ad with your, sometimes your friend's picture is on it. Well, that's kind of how Facebook does its sponsored links thing. And so everybody thought, oh, no, they're going to take my picture and they're going to use it in an ad for Pepsi or something. Nilay Patel, who is an attorney as well as a gadget journalist, writes for The Verge, pointed out quite accurately that Facebook's old terms were worse because they were vague. They didn't assert any... They didn't say anything. They just said, we have the right to do anything we want. He said, all Instagram did was is say more specifically what they want and limit what they could do. They literally, in the new terms of service, Nilay pointed out, were more limiting than the old terms of service. Nevertheless, because they were more specific about advertising, it scared people. Instagram users revolted. Instagram backed down, went back to their old terms of service. And as Nilay has pointed out, what a victory. What a victory for Instagram. They get the more loosely relaxed terms of service. They can still do everything they said in the new ones and more. And they made people happy. He said from now on, he said the lesson learned by this... He said companies now will be very vague in their terms of service. Why should they tell you what they're going to do? It just makes people upset. It just angers them. Nobody reads the terms of service, it turns out, unless you change them. So if you're, in fact, the old Instagram terms of service said, we reserve the rights to your music, audio files. There's no music and audio on Instagram. It was some old boilerplate that they reused for the photo service. Ah, just like fun business to cover. It's just nonstop excitement. Meanwhile, Facebook has done, I think, a good thing. In fact, if you go into your Facebook page, they'll alert you. We've got new settings, and I think they are clearer and easier to protect your privacy on Facebook now. That's nice. They also added a new form of poke that apparently Mark Zuckerberg wrote himself. And the sound it makes, I haven't heard it yet, but we'll find it, and I'll play it for you. The sound it makes is Mark Zuckerberg's voice. And it's a response to something called Snapchat, which all the kids are using these days. Snapchat is interesting. You take a picture and send it to somebody, but they can only look at it for 10 seconds, and then it disappears. It actually self-destructs. This picture will self-destruct in 10 seconds. And Facebook thought, hey, that's a good idea. So now they're doing it in their app. It's on iPhone only. It's called Poke for Mobile. And you can send somebody a sound, a picture, some text. And it disappears in 10. It self-destructs in 10 seconds. So I think probably so that there's no incriminating evidence. It's gone. I will find Mike Zuckerberg's sound that he makes when you poke people now. Poke has always been the thing that bugs me on Facebook. I just ignore pokes. Do you use pokes? Do you poke people on Facebook? I guess it's kind of like a way of flirting a little bit. It's like when the kid pulls the pigtails of the girl in front of him. I poke you. Anyway, you can get it if you have an iPhone. You can download an update to Facebook, and I'm sure it'll come out on Android soon. We'll talk about gadgets. We'll talk about phones. There's some great tablets out there and a lot of gifts. Oh, here we go. Here we go. Chat room, you're so good. Scooter X in the chat room, one of our chat moderators, says, here's the voice of Mark Zuckerberg poking you. This is what it sounds like. Really?
Poke.
That's possibly even more annoying than the old poke. Even more annoying. Poke. 8888 Ask Leo. No, that's him. That's Mark's voice. Yes, 888-827-5536. We go to the phones next. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Poke. 8888-ASK-LEO. 888-827-5536. That's the phone number. Poke. You can poke me anytime. We're going to take some calls, starting with Brian in New York. Hi, Brian. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hey, Leo. Brian here in New York. Just got out of the Windows Surface pop-up store and I guess in Time Warner Center.
So yeah, Microsoft's decided to keep these pop-up stores alive after the holidays, and in fact, to put Surface now in Best Buy and other stores. Did you take a look at the Surface?
You know, I took a look at the Surface, and you know, to me, it strikes me as sort of a Generation One device, right? I mean,
oh yeah,
you know, you can't really run full Windows software on it, but the salesperson was actually kind of knowledgeable, or the Windows person, or the consultant, whoever they had, they were knowledgeable. They pointed out that the pro version of the Surface, I guess due out in the next couple months or so, will actually allow you to run Windows, full Windows software. So then, you know, they may have something. I'm not sure exactly what the price point's going to be.
It's going to be twice as much.
Well, in that case, I don't think they'll sell too many of them, but, you know, you never know.
It's interesting because your confusion is exactly what I predicted. They have three versions of Windows 8. There's the Windows Phone, the Windows RT, which is what you were looking at, and then Windows 8 Desktop. And while they look exactly the same on the front page, they are three different operating systems, and you have to buy the apps for each. So if you want Windows, traditional old-school Windows apps, yeah, you have to buy Windows 8 Desktop, and that's not out till next month. Also, yeah, battery life is half. Costs twice as much with half the battery life.
Yeah, there you go, figure. But anyway, the reason I was calling today was I had a networking question, a wireless networking question. I live in Manhattan in New York City. I think you're familiar with it.
I've heard of it,
I live in an apartment building.
Mm-hmm.
I know you grew up out this way.
I was born out there. That's right, yeah.
Oh, yeah. I don't know exactly where, but, you know, where were you born, actually?
Upper West Side.
Yeah, that's where I just was, a couple blocks away from your old stomping ground. but in any event, we live in an apartment building. You know, the walls are thick. They're these old plaster walls, you know, built in the mid-century design. I think they've got some sort of steel rebar in there.
Bingo.
And, you know, it's not a huge apartment, right? Maybe it's 1,100 square feet or something on that tune, which by anywhere else in the world would be looked at as a shoebox. By Manhattan standards, it's pretty decent size. And, you know, I had an old G router that I wired up, and I just could not get the signal from the front of the house to the back of the house.
Yeah. So, you know, you hit the nail on the head when you said old walls. The Wi-Fi is radio, right? And the problem with radio is not plaster, it's not lath, it's not wood, it's metal. So if there is rebar in those walls, regardless of thickness, that will bounce the signal off of it.
Yeah, so what I did was I decided to say, you know, it's an old G router, a Linksys that I bought years ago. So let me upgrade. I bought an Asus AC router, figuring, maybe that, you know, has a few antennas sticking out the back. Maybe that would help. But guess what? Same problem.
Yeah.
If I put the router in the back of the house, I can't get the signal to the front. And if I put it in the front, I can't get it to the back. So I came up with this ingenious, I don't know, nobody really knew much about this, but something called a MoCA bridge. I don't know if you're familiar with this technology called MoCA.
Yeah, I am, actually.
But I used what's called a MoCA bridge to be able to offload the Ethernet signal to the existing cable wire.
Right.
And essentially run a second wireless access point in the back of the house. So now I've got, with this 1,100-square-foot apartment, I've got a wireless access point up front, the new one that I bought. And I took the old one and ran that in the back. I had to kind of figure out exactly how to do it, put it into bridging mode so that it's not assigning its own IP addresses and so on and so forth. And it actually works great with one caveat.
Uh-oh.
The caveat is that when you're moving a device from the front of the house to the back of the house, it doesn't switch automatically between the two different wireless access points that I have. And typically you have to go into your settings on your device. For instance, the Samsung Note 2 that I picked up based on your strong recommendation, It's a terrific device. I'm really enjoying it considerably, but when I move from one area of the house to the other, it's strong enough, the signal, to stay attached to the old network.
Yeah.
But, you know, I can't actually get any throughput as a result of it.
So here's a suggestion for you. First of all, let me explain what MoCA is. It stands for multimedia over coax. MoCA means that so one of the issues, of course, is getting through these walls. But even if it's a upstairs downstairs situation or just a long distance, Wi-Fi often can't get over the distance. My first recommendation is to go completely wireless and try something called WDS, which is essentially a Wi-Fi repeater midway between the Wi-Fi access spot and where you want to go. It picks up the signal and rebroadcasts it. And almost every manufacturer makes a Wi-Fi repeater. Apple's Airport Express is a repeater for Airport Extreme. Linksys, D-Link, Netgear, they all make Wi-Fi repeaters using WDS. So that's the easiest way to do it. But if that still doesn't work, MoCA is an interesting idea because essentially you're using your coax. And since the coax for your cable system is often wiring through each room, you could put a bridge on each end of the coax that turns the Ethernet into coax and then picks it up on the other side. There are pros and cons on this, of course. If your signal, your cable has to be good. It can't have a lot of splitters on it and so forth. But it's worth trying. It shouldn't interfere with cable television or anything like that. And if it works for you, that's great. Now, one key, and I think this is what you're running into, is if you've got two routers, only one of them should actually be doing routing. So I think your issue, Brian, is that second router, you have to put in something called bridge mode. I know it's confusing because we're now using the word bridge in two different meanings. In this case, that second router, just as a WDS router would be, has to be set up not to assign IP addresses, not to do what's called DHCP. It should just be a bridge. In other words, a passive, I got this signal and I'm passing it on device. A repeater, in effect. So if you're using MoCA or you're using WDS, that second device should be in bridge mode. Now, you could use a regular router for this purpose, or you can use something that's just a bridge that doesn't have some of the router hardware. You only want one router on a network at a time. You can also use, if you're going wire to switch, but the idea is we only want one active router on the network. And then your Note 2 and your other devices, your laptops, won't be confused. It'll all have the same name. It'll all look the same. What you've effectively done is set up two access points on either end of the apartment. The second access point is getting its connection from the first, but you don't want that. You want to disable DHCP is the key, or put it in bridge mode. Most routers have that setting. It's a good solution. It's clever. And it is an issue, especially in older buildings. It's not the thickness of the wall as much as the rebar. They call it a Faraday cage, named after the brilliant scientist who explained how electromagnetic forces work in the first place. The Faraday cage is an interesting thing. If you put it, in fact, if you're really paranoid and you don't want the FBI or the NSA to snoop on you, you can use a Faraday cage. If you put copper, just a copper screening in your walls or around you, it will literally block electrical signals. It doesn't have to be solid. It doesn't have to be a sheet of copper, just a copper screen. That's why metal screens often can cause a problem with Wi-Fi. Hey, thanks for the call, Brian. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Scott Wilkinson, our home theater guy, coming up. Scott Wilkinson's here, our home theater guru. And he, of course, writes for The Secrets of Home Theater and Hi-Fi at hometheaterhi-fi.com and joins us every week and does a podcast called Home Theater Geeks every Monday on the network, the Twit Network. Hey, Scott.
Hey, Leo.
So you finally, I saw The Hobbit last night. Merry Christmas to you. And you saw it, I guess, finally.
I did finally after the aborted attempt the other night. But
so now yeah, I did go. I saw it in IMAX standard frame rate.
Yeah, and I'm sorry to hear that because I really wanted to hear your impression of the high frame rate. I saw it in IMAX high frame rate.
Yeah. I didn't know such a thing was possible, but I guess in San Francisco, the Sony Metron, which, by the way, I guess now it's the Lowe's Metron. No, by the way, it's now the AMC Metron. It's clear. Seriously, it's been through three owners, and I think it's just falling apart. It's very sad. There was nobody.
It is very sad.
600 seats in that IMAX theater, 150 sold on a Friday night, 6:30 show.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, that's amazing.
And 20 of the 150 were me.
We're Twit.
We're Twit. We're my company. So it was, you know, and there was one person at the counter, and it was terrible. It was horrible experience. So maybe, now they do have HFR. They have something called ETX. What's ETX?
ETX is AMC's sort of, what that stands for is Extended Theater Experience. And so it's a kind of an upgraded theater experience. They use two projectors like IMAX for 3D. So you get a brighter picture, which is good.
Okay.
They use the same type of glasses as Real D 3D. So yeah. IMAX uses a different type of polarization. So those two types of glasses aren't cross-compatible.
Right.
And in some AMC ETX theaters, they also have Dolby Atmos sound system, which puts speakers all around.
This one had Atmos, that's the overhead speaker system as well.
With also overhead speakers, right. Yeah. And objects are steered around by the sound mixer so that they fly around much more convincingly than a standard 5.1 or 7.1.
Notice, by the way, neither of us are talking about the movie itself. This is what happens when it's the specs. This is in the early days of hi-fis. It wasn't about the music you were playing. It was about the reproductive system. It was about how many watts per channel RMS and distort and all of that stuff. And then eventually, about the mid-60s to late-60s, it became about the music again. In computers, it was the same thing. We talked about speeds and feeds, how many megahertz, how much RAM.
Right.
And now we're more and more, thanks to things like the iPad, talking about what can it do. And I think we've kind of gone into a second childhood for a film where it's all about the specs, the speeds and feeds, and so much less about the content.
Well, in this particular case, I have to agree with you because this is a new paradigm for movies. It's shooting them at higher frame rate. And so, of course, everyone's going to be focused on looking at that. I was focused on looking at that, at least for the first part of the movie. And I have to say, I'm sorry you didn't see it in high frame rate, because I would love to have talked to you about that. But we can do that, you know, if you see it again, try to see it in high frame rate. I found it to be very compelling. Now, I know that Vincent LaFerre has written about this and thought that it was terrible.
Yeah, he's a wonderful cinematographer.
He is. And I respect his opinion greatly. And a lot of people have spoken up and said, it took him out of the picture.
Right.
He makes the point that it took him out of the story and made him concentrate on this hyper-realistic looking image.
He said an interesting thing. He went to see it first in HF, a high frame rate. And then he went to see it in the old school 2D, 24 frames per second. And he said, now, remember, this is just a small sample, but he said the audience in the high frame rate IMAX, 3D, didn't there's a wonderful meal scene at the beginning. It was very funny and fun, but they weren't laughing. They weren't responding because he felt they were so engrossed in the technology that they weren't really getting the movie. And he said, when I saw it in the old school 2D with a slow frame rate, people were laughing and enjoying the film. Interesting.
Yep, he did.
Yeah.
By the way, he also saw it in 3D, 24 frames per second. Three times he went to that movie in one day.
Wow.
That's 9 hours of sitting through this movie
Whether you liked the movie or not, and I loved it. I thought it was much, but now perhaps because I'd read all the bad reviews and I thought it was going to be terrible.
Right.
But I thought it was great, and I'm a big fan of The Hobbit, the book.
Yes.
And I felt it was very true to the book, and it's a kid's story. And so it had some fun, childish stuff, and I thought it was quite good. I really, really enjoyed it. And
it was a lot better than I thought it was going to be, too, for me. I'm not a fan of Lord of the Rings.
Right.
And I can't say that I thought this was a super great movie, but it was certainly better than I expected.
Yeah.
But I admit, I was looking at the 48 frames. I was really kind of trying to study it because that's what I do.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And there were moments when I thought it just looked super great. It was so clear. Motion. You said you saw a lot of motion artifacts.
Yeah, that surprised me. Now, that's okay. So sad that we have to say, well, I saw it in 3D IMAX, but not high frame rate.
Versions.
Yeah. So because I thought, well, I bet you this is because it was shot. It was shot, by the way, we should say, the native format is very high resolution 3D full frame rate, 48 frame rate. That's how it was shot. So I thought, well, I bet you when they had to step it down to a worse frame rate, because you lose frames, you lose data, and that's why the motion looked so terrible. It looked worse than a normal movie.
Absolutely. It could very well be.
Yeah.
I do plan to go see it at 24 frames in a Dolby Atmos theater, so just to make a comparison and see. So I'll be interested to see if that motion the motion artifacts really are as pronounced as you saw them.
I
hope they're not, but
it was
weird. It's bad.
Yeah, it was disturbing.
But at 48 frames per second, the motion as the camera panned and as things moved across the screen, you still had motion blur, but it wasn't nearly as bad as it normally is. Things were much clearer, which I really liked. Sometimes things looked super great, and occasionally it did look like, you remember public television in the early days used to show some specials, and they looked like they were filmed on video, which they were.
They were.
and it looked kind of funky and weird.
Yeah.
There were moments in The Hobbit that looked exactly like that.
Yeah.
But it wasn't consistent. It didn't happen all the time. It was only occasional shots. And I wasn't, sadly, taking notes about, you know, which moments those were. I will next time.
No, I'm with you. In fact, that was one thing that did take me out of the movie. Every once in a while, it looked too real, even without 48 frames per second. It almost felt like the lighting was too bright. It did what I felt like it should have been darker and murkier, and I was seeing too much.
Yeah, Vincent LaFerre said the same thing.
Well, he said it's funny. He said the lighting looked bad in the high frame rate and normal in the 24P.
Yeah,
he thought it was well lit in 24P. You know, this is. I'm sure most people are going, oh, who cares? I just want to see
the movie.
Is it a good movie or not? And I think it is a good movie. I quite enjoyed it, and I will have to see it about 8 or 9 more times in every format. And then in about 3 years, I'll let you know which format you should go see it in.
Right, exactly. I'm not sure I could sit through it, you know, 5 more times. You know,
one of the controversies was, believe it or not, the angle of the lens that Peter Jackson used, but that's for another time. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Ooh. Or punk. 8888. Ask Leo. That's the phone number. Love to hear your reaction. Well, there's so many different versions of The Hobbit. If you saw it in a version that you particularly liked or disliked, you can let us know about that, too. Let's pick up line 2 and say hello to Cordell from North Carolina. Hi, Cordell. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi, Leo.
Hey.
I just want to say I really like your show.
Thank you.
I recently had the hard drive in my computer go out, and so I'm looking to buy a new one, and I was wondering what you had to say about what to get, different kinds,
brands. People often ask about brands, and I think there's only a few companies now making hard drives. There's Western Digital, Seagate, and they pretty much bought everybody else out as far as spinning hard drives go. I buy Western Digitals. I generally, depending on whether I want speed or whether I want cool performance, low energy performance, I'll either get the Caviar Black for speed or the Caviar Green for performance. But I think you'd probably be a good time, as Superman in our chat room says, for the obligatory SSD plug. So the biggest change in hard drives over the last 2 decades... Go ahead.
I've only got a 1.5 gigabit per second SATA.
Okay, that's
controller.
Okay, excellent. Now you're talking my language, Cordell. So solid state drives have made a huge difference in performance for 2 reasons. One, because they have zero seek time. They're random access, so it doesn't take any time for the drive to find the data and feed it to you. And the other is just raw read speed. The write speed's a little slower, but the read speed's amazing. However, you won't get that benefit unless you have a fast enough, what we call I/O bus, input-output bus, and that's just what you were talking about. Their SATA connection, which is the way the drive connects, is only 1.5 gigabytes per second. That's the slowest SATA out there. There's 3 and 6 out now. And really, to take advantage of a SSD drive, you'd need at least a SATA 3 connection. So your slower one, you're right. There's no point in spending. And the reason SSDs are an issue, that comes up, is there's no reason to buy an SSD if you're not going to see the benefit, because they are more expensive. They're more expensive. So, for this same amount of storage. Now, the prices have dropped dramatically. Gigabyte, buck a gigabyte or less now. So that's getting to the point. I'm sorry. Is that right? Buck a gigabyte. Yes. So that's getting to the point where they're starting to get affordable. I would say, though, in your case, yeah, I would say probably a Western Digital. Now, some people are saying the Western Digital Red. That's another. They have black.
Or Lightning.
Say again?
Mm-hmm. But that's more for NAS, not a desktop.
Yeah, I don't think you need the Red. So those are enterprise hard drives. I'm just looking here at the three different. Newegg is where I tend to buy my drives. Just they seem to have good prices. A 3 terabyte WD Green, which is a good low power drive, is $139 for 3 terabytes. Wow. A 1 terabyte Red is $119. Enterprise, of course, top of the line, but you don't. I think blue or black is going to be fine. What is the blue? They've all got colors now. They're all in living color. I'm not sure what the blue is. Let's look at that. I would say Western Digital probably in my. For a while, they had a little bit of a problem. Western Digital's drives were had a software issue. And let's see, 500 gigabytes, $64, 7,200 RPM for daily computing is the blue. I don't think they make those anymore. Get the black. That's what I would get. it's funny how this changes. Western Digital drives did have a firmware issue for a while that was causing data corruption. Those have been fixed. So I think you're okay going with the Western Digital drives. I don't think it makes that much difference anymore, to be honest with you. Mark is in Phoenix. Hi, Mark. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hey, how you doing? How you doing, Leo?
I'm great, Mark. Welcome.
Hey, before I get into my question, I was going to make a recommendation for you.
Yes, sir.
Book, when I listened to it on audiobooks on Audible, I thought, Leo's got to read this book, so take a note.
All right.
And you ever heard of a guy named John Scalzi?
I love John Scalzi.
So you have probably already read the Android Stream thing.
I haven't. I will read that. Tell me about it. Is it sci-fi?
It's sci-fi, and it's also humorous, but he's a really good writer. He obviously knows his tech.
Yeah.
He knows, he obviously knows all the future stuff, you know, he's,
I love good sci-fi.
Really listen to the book.
Yeah, I think I've only read one of his books, and I can't remember which one it is, but, you know, you reminded me. I got to start reading more. When you find an author that you really like, you should read all of his books. You're saying the one to start with is The Android's Dream?
Yeah, that's a great book. Right. He's had some other ones, too. Like, he had The Old Man's War, and he had Ghost Brigades and some other stuff,
yeah.
too.
Yeah.
So, see, what happened was I read the one book, right? Well, then, all of a sudden, you got to go read all the other
books. You got to read them all.
Like Hamilton, right? Because I started off with Hamilton, right? So I read all of those.
Love his stuff, yeah.
Books, and then I just went through all of his books, and then R.R. Martin went through all of his books. So
right.
I think I got like 152 books on here. Thank you for doing that for me there, Leo.
I'm with you. There's nothing like sci-fi for leaving your cares behind and going to a future world. You know, I'm ready. You know, we're all going to pass on to to another plane at some point in our existence. That's just the way life is. The only thing that really gripes me about it is I'd like to see the future. I want to find out how it's going to turn out. So reading sci-fi is the closest thing I'm gonna get to that. So what can I do for you?
So what I was going to mention was I am trying to wrap my mind around the what Microsoft is going to do about the worst product that they've ever created and ever, and that is Windows 8.
You're not alone when you say that. I mean, there's a wide range of reactions. Some people love it. Some people hate it. There's no question that Microsoft bet the farm on Windows 8, that they are all in, to mix my metaphors. This is it.
They need to make an apology to their customers. Here's the thing I don't like about it, and that is, you know, when you talk about Windows, that to me, that means you want to run your application in something called a window. And so the Windows 8 applications don't even run in Windows. You can't even put two. I mean, in theory, they have that bar thing that you can set them side by side.
Yeah.
But it's like they're degressing. The start button, I think, is only the beginning of the disaster. It's the worst product ever.
I don't disagree with you, Mark. I think it's early for us to make a decision because it's brand new. There is currently in both Windows RT and Windows 8 desktop, there still is the desktop mode, which is just like the old Windows 7 with windowing and everything. But I agree with you. What Microsoft apparently wants to do, and Apple's doing this somewhat too, is move us into a tablet world. You know, in tablets, apps are full screen. And Apple introduced this into its operating system about a year ago, this full screen mode. And now Microsoft's doing it too. And Metro apps run full screen. And so Metro, which is the new user interface, is basically a tablet mode. Now, you don't have to use Metro, but you're right, that Mark, that's kind of the future, obviously. That's where they're headed.
So the question I have is, what, you know, people ask me, I'm the go-to guy, right? I mean, I do tech for a living, and people come to me, and they want to know, what should I get, right? And so for the last few months, all I've said is, well, don't get Windows 8. And so the question is, what do you tell people who are you get a new machine? I think Microsoft should give you Windows 7. What's wrong with Windows 7?
Yeah.
Windows 7 is a great operating system.
Yeah, it is. We do live in this technology world. We live in this upgrade or die paradigm where if you just didn't change it, people would say, oh, well, obviously you've got no new ideas, your history. So even if Windows 7 was the perfect Windows, which I think you could argue, that certainly was the best version of Windows to date, Microsoft wouldn't be able to just sit on that. They'd have to upgrade it. And in this case, they decided to completely reimagine what an operating system would be like. Windows 8 is what they came up with, and it's such a change. Understandably, people are upset. Now, my answer is a little more nuanced, Mark. I actually, when I talk to the person, I try to understand what their needs and interests are, and I do recommend Windows 8 for some people and Windows 7 for others. Let's talk more when we come back. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the Tech Guy, and it's time to talk about computers, the internet, cell phones, camcorders, MP3 players, and yes, Windows 8. Is it awful? Is it horrible? What's your opinion? Mark brought up a good point. He's a tech guru in Phoenix, and he says, I just can't recommend Windows 8 to people when they ask me. And I kind of understand that. My response is a little more nuanced. If it's somebody who's not used Windows before, well, obviously they're not going to have any preconceived notions. I think Windows, I like the interface, the Metro interface. By the way, Microsoft says, Microsoft and Apple both have done something incredibly stupid, in my opinion. Microsoft chose a name Metro for this full screen tiled interface. And then a year in, is sued by a company in Germany, and they can't use the name anymore. So they say, we're not going to call it Metro. We're not going to give it a name. Oh, great. So that thing, that thing on the screen, that thing that's unique, the tiles and the interface and the full screen, that has no name. No, it has no name. Okay. Apple did the same thing. Remember with the last iPad, they said, no, it's just the iPad, the new iPad, you can call it. The only thing wrong with that is it's not the new iPad anymore. Now it's the iPad that came before. It's the old new iPad. Now the new iPad's the new iPad. There's a reason why we name things. Naming things is valuable, is useful, and as somebody who tries to talk about things, having a name for it makes it a whole lot easier to do radio. You know that thing, the Windows, the new Windows look, that thing? Metro. I think Metro is, I like Metro. It's great on a phone. In fact, I would say and this is purely my opinion, most don't agree with me, but I would say that the perfect expression of Windows 8 is actually the Windows Phone. The Windows Phone 8 is just right. It's exactly, you know, full screen. Of course, on a phone, you don't want to have Windows. It's too small. The Metro interface, the tiles that are live, that show you information, they're fantastic. It's easy to use. It's clean. It's efficient. Snappy, even on slower hardware, which is something you cannot say about the iPhone or Android phone, especially about Android. These are all selling points on the phone. They're kind of selling points on a Surface RT tablet, because that's halfway, half and half. It's a tablet, so, you know, it should have a tablet interface, I guess, full screen and all of that. But it's being billed as Windows, and that means people want to do things like run, I don't know, Microsoft Office on there. And the problem is Microsoft Office doesn't run in the Metro interface. Microsoft Office runs on the desktop. So you've got this strange hybrid environment where you have a wonderful start menu, and, or whatever you call that, the start page, the Metro tiles. But if you want to run Office, in effect, you're running desktop. Suddenly you're using the desktop again, just like Windows 7, minus the most commonly used interface item, the start button. It's gone. So now we have to go back to the start screen, the Metro interface, and the start screen if we want to do anything else. You can see wherein the problem lies. But even then, with Surface RT, with the tablet, it's okay. But now let's go to a windowing operating system, the Microsoft Windows on a computer. Then it really starts to break down because, as Mark said, nobody wants a full screen application. People want Windows, especially if you have a larger screen. I try to use my OS X desktop on a 27-inch screen. The last thing you want, you're browsing around, is a full screen app. It's too big. It's 27 inches. It's too big. I don't want a 27-inch browser. I feel like I'm a tiny person in giant land. I want Windows. That's why you get a big screen. So you can have, because you're more productive, because you can have four things open at once and see all of them. You got your email, you got your browser, you got your word processor all open, all fully, you know, usable. That's why you get, why would I want on 27 inches, why would I want a full screen? And that's the problem, is this metaphor is effectively bringing tablet or touch interface, I think the phone interface, to a big screen computer. And that's where it breaks down. And that's why Microsoft's got I agree with Mark, it's kind of got a problem. Because who uses Windows? Desktop users. You know, yeah, laptops. Windows has no heritage as a tablet operating system. It's been a flop for 10 years as a tablet operating system. The phone came way later than the iPhone and Android phones. People think of Windows as a desktop operating system. And that's where it fails. Oh, now you got a problem, huh? Laura in Santa Clarita, California. You're next. Hi, Laura. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Leo, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm great, but I'm having a small problem with my kids. we limit electronic time, including TV, computer net, and games.
Yeah, I call it screen time. I think that's exactly right.
Yeah, anything electronic is what we consider.
Yeah, yeah.
But the little ankle biters are getting up before their alarms go off and watching TV.
Yes. No, you didn't do that. You didn't Saturday morning. Did you get up and watch cartoons?
No. They have to be dressed, have cereal eaten, be ready for school. And then
good for you, Laura. I like that. You're a good mom. I think that's exactly right.
Thank you. But they're getting up before their alarms go off. They've trained themselves now.
Not just the alarms, before mom gets up.
Right.
let's be more to the point. Before you're up, they sneak upstairs and they watch TV.
Yeah. So we have NetNanny on the computer, and I'm looking. I don't care if it's software or hardware, but we need something on the computer, on the TV, so that we can control when they can access it.
Yeah, you want parental controls for the TV? Yeah.
Yeah.
There was a, in fact, I think I showed it on Regis and Kelly. That's how long that was. There was a box that you would attach to the TV that would turn it off. In fact, it was a good idea because you give kids a little credit card, and when they got stars and brownie points that you'd add time to the card, and then they have to put in the card to watch TV, and when they'd used up their time, the TV would go off, and then go off and do chores to get more TV time. Wasn't that a good idea?
I like that.
I know. I loved it. It's gone. Oh. It was such a good idea, but I guess nobody bought it. So now you can look for parental controls on either your cable box. Most cable boxes have that.
We just have direct cable to the TV.
Yeah, okay.
I don't have a box.
You don't have a set-top box.
No.
Yeah. Because Comcast and Time Warner and the other cable companies, Cox, have added these parental controls for exactly this reason to their set-top box.
So we have Time Warner. Can I go to them and get a box?
Yeah, you should ask them beforehand, do you have parental controls? I think they do. I have Comcast, so I'm not sure what Time Warner's setup is. But the idea was that the cable box has all of the features, all of those features that you want in it. Now, some TVs might as well. Oh, wait a minute. The TV Guardian, maybe it's still available. TV Timer Bob, it's called. Or the Time Machine. There are still boxes. That's nice. Somebody sent me a link. There are still boxes.
Thank you.
Yeah. So this might be another way to go. I love this idea. FamilySafeMedia.com has three or four of these where this is great. There's one called the Token Timer. You give kids tokens as they do their chores, and then they get 35 minutes per token.
Now, what about when I want to watch TV?
Oh yeah, you can get around that. there's a parental unlock, obviously. Isn't this a good idea?
Okay.
Wow, that's cool. So yeah, there are a number of hardware devices that will do this as well. That's very cool. And then ask your cable company, because of course most cable companies, understanding this problem, build this into their set top box. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
And he loves to party down. Rorschach's rents to the animals.
Yeah, when he's not clowning around.
Why nutty?
Beat up some thugs. Say no to drugs. Be in bed by 10. But if trouble's about, you'd best watch out for the Watchman.
Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888 Ask Leo. Thomas in Anaheim, California. Very patient. Thank you for holding on, Thomas. Leo Laporte here.
My pleasure, Leo. Thanks for taking my call.
My pleasure.
So I have laptop issues. The story starts with me about a month ago buying an HP laptop with Windows 8, no touchscreen. Soon find out that Windows 8, although I like it, is entirely unusable without the touchscreen. Take that laptop back.
Good.
Step two was to buy the Lenovo Twist. Found it to be underpowered and found the Twist not to work well. The screen was orientating itself upside down. Very annoying.
That is annoying, yeah.
If you've ever played around with one, you soon find that if you don't twist it back correctly, the screen stays upside down in laptop mode, so you actually have to pick it up, tilt it backwards to get it reoriented right.
That's such a pain.
The little compass inside isn't working. So
yeah.
My question for you is this. I need something powerful with at least 6 gigs of RAM because I like to run Photoshop and I think I need that much. I am looking at the Acer V5 touchscreen because, again, if I'm committing to Windows 8, I'm committing to a touchscreen. So my question for you is, do you know of a hybrid, because I like that concept, that is powerful enough to fulfill my needs? And if you don't, is a Acer V5 touchscreen and then a iPad mini combo the next best guess? I'd like to stay below $1,200, but I need your opinion.
Yeah. So effectively, you want a tablet and a laptop.
Yeah, I like that technology. I bought the Lenovo thinking that the laptop-tablet hybrid was cool, and I do think that they are, but the Lenovo was underpowered. It obviously had technical issues.
Yeah.
I know that Dell and a couple of these other companies, HP, are creating a hybrid, but none of them seem to have the gigs in RAM that I need to support Photoshop.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. We also looked, we've got a review show called Before You Buy. We looked at the Lenovo Yoga, which is a similar kind of, we call these convertibles. They're laptops within the screen, and some form flips over and then becomes a tablet. They're thick, though, for a tablet, if you think about it. I mean, they're pretty thick.
They're great. But again, the Lenovo Twist, the Yoga, the Twist, the Dell.
If they don't reorient, then I'm wondering maybe this is a problem with Windows 8 more than the hardware.
I also didn't like the little nipple button to.
That's a Lenovo thing. So I agree with you. I can never use that thing. I like a trackpad the best. Acer's good. Asus is good as well. ASUS. I haven't tried their convertibles though, so I don't know if they have a similar kind of problem with responding.
Yeah, I'm thinking that the technology will work itself out in a few generations, but I need a powerful laptop now. I'm running a 3-year-old Dell with the vent is still on the bottom, so it overheats in an hour or two. So I need a touchscreen laptop, and I want a tablet. And it seems to me, and this is why I'm hoping to either confirm or deny with you, that my option is to really get a powerful touchscreen laptop and then get a separate tablet.
I have to say, I do agree with your initial assessment that Windows 8 needs touch, and so I would get a touch, even if it's just a laptop with touch. I would get a touch device when you're using Windows 8. I think you're right on that. You don't use it all the time. You'll use a combination of touch, mouse, and keyboard. There are just times when you reach out and you want to touch stuff. Now, we've got our Flowmaster, Alex Gumpel, who is a big Windows 8 fan, and he gave a big thumbs up to the Dell XPS 12. He liked that one a lot.
Okay.
And that is all. That is a convertible as well. It turns into a tablet. Unfortunately, the problem with Dell, of course, is its mail order. If you can find it in a store, it'd be worth looking at. It's not cheap. It's $11.99. But what the Dell does is it has a frame that the screen pivots within.
Yeah, and I like that one too, and I'm glad that you brought that up. So the question is, do I spend $1,200 on that Dell, which is a nice convertible, or do I spend $800 on the Acer with 8 gigs of RAM and then a $350 tablet, iPad mini, and call it a day? Two devices.
Well, there's a big difference between an iPad and Windows 8. I don't know if the iPad's going to suit your needs. For instance, you said you'd use Photoshop. Obviously, on the iPad, there is no Photoshop. There's similar, but nothing as powerful. What do you want the tablet for?
Entertainment. Look at pictures, play, poker.
Well, it's pretty clear that the iPad is the creme de la creme there.
Sure.
So I do think that it's not a bad idea, your idea to have two devices. I mean, there's a certain pleasure to having one device. You can travel with it, and it's very easy. But my problem with convertibles in general is they're 16:9, so they're kind of strange looking. They're tall, and they're thick because they have to have the keyboard folded under. iPad is elegant and thin. An iPad mini is about as portable, thin, and attractive of devices I can think of. I wish the screen were better. I'm disappointed Apple didn't put a Retina screen on it. But that one quibble aside, it is really great. $329. And then pick the touch screen but not convertible Windows 8 laptop. I think that's probably a good choice.
And you have no reservations on Acer?
No, I like Acer stuff. Asus, Acer, Dell. I like Lenovo, too. I understand your reservation on Lenovo. So, yeah, go with it. The Acer's fine.
Excellent. Thanks for the time, Leo.
My pleasure, yeah. Those are very nice laptops. Everybody's making these Ultrabooks now, which are extremely small, light, thin laptops. I kind of am with Thomas, though, on that convertible problem. The problem in general with Windows 8 is it's a liger. It's not a lion or a tiger. It's a liger. It's a mule. It's a mix of a tablet operating system and a desktop operating system, as I was saying earlier. You add to that the convertible. Now it's the hardware is a laptop hardware and a tablet hardware. And I think a liger is not as good as a lion and a tiger. So go with a lion plus tiger. Bill in Calgary, it says California, but I'm thinking this is Calgary, Alberta, Canada. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Leo. Gee, it's great to talk to you after all these years.
I know it's Canada now because you're the friendliest people in the world in Calgary. Bill, can you hold on after all these years for a few more minutes? We got to take a break. It's the bottom of the hour. I'll be back in a moment and have more with you. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Could he be in Aruba? Could he be in Jamaica? Girl, I don't know where he is. Johnny Jett's joining us. And now it's the radio, so I'm going to have to describe. I'm looking out the window where you are, Johnny. I see palm trees. I see a beach. I see cabanas on the beach. It's a beautiful day. The sky is clear. The sun is shining. And I'm really jealous. And the trick is we have to figure out where you are. And you told me something that kind of surprised me. You're in the continental United States. So I'm going to guess, is it North Carolina?
No.
Myrtle Beach?
A little more south.
It's Florida.
You got it.
All right.
I'm in Delray Beach, Florida. Delray Beach Marriott.
How nice. Johnny Jett's got the best job in the world. In fact, when he joins us, and by the way, he's a new regular on the show. He's going to join us at this time every week, or at least when he's available every week. But he's always somewhere else. Last week, you were in Toronto. You just travel. How many days a year do you spend out of your house?
About 250.
250 out of 365?
Yeah.
You were telling me that, what was it, October? You did how many miles?
I did 45,000 in 30 days.
Oh, Johnny. Now, one thing that's happening now, there's a big, big snowstorm in the Midwest of the U.S., in the Plain States. And, of
course,
whenever I flew cross-country during the winter, actually summer too, I always tried to avoid Chicago because it's either thunderstorms in the summer or it's snow in the winter. But
smart.
But Chicago, but a lot of the airlines, that's their hub. United, that's where they stop. So what do you do? How can you avoid this problem?
Well, number one, you want to avoid hubs that do have problems like that. So you're smart right there. I also, you know what? Some people don't think about Toronto, actually, for using a hub in the wintertime, because Toronto is actually prepared. They have plenty of snow plows, and they're just on it. But, you know, I always try to go south. Like, I would rather go to Dallas or Houston in the wintertime if you need to connect. But
that's
obviously, it's best... It's obviously best not to connect. So pay the extra money and not connect. And if you really need to be somewhere that's really important, you got to go at least the day before, and including cruises, because you never know with mechanical problems or weather delays.
Johnny and I both are cruise fans. We love going on boats. But you're absolutely right. When it's time for that ship to sail, they sail. They don't care if you're delayed. So come in day before, because you don't want to be rushing from the airport, arrive at the dock, and wave as the boat is sailing out. That would be the worst feeling ever.
It is. But go at least one day before. Usually those ports are great anyway, so you won't be there early. Relax, get accustomed to the times, whatever, if it is a time change.
We're going on that Seabourn cruise in... September from Venice to Istanbul. So we decided to speak Venice. What could be wrong with getting to Venice a few days early, right?
That's right. Actually, I just did a Seabourn cruise last year out of Venice.
Oh.
So, and I went a day early and I stayed an extra day.
Yeah. Seabourn has a pre-cruise hotel that looked really nice. So I just got a couple of nights there. We're going to stay there. Here's a really... Go ahead.
And by the way, I'll give you some tips for that when we're off the air or another time for Venice to finding the airport, because it's not that easy.
Yeah. Do they even have an airport? They don't have cars. How could they have an airport? What do you got? Flying on a gondola?
You can find the airport. They'll pick you up in a water taxi, or you can take the bus, Vaporetto.
Wait a minute.
Really cheap.
Wait a minute. There's a Vaporetto, which is a boat, from the airport?
Yeah. They'll go right to the port. It'll go right to the port where the...
Well, our hotel's on a canal, so the hotel has a door on the canal. So you take a boat from your plane to your hotel.
Yes, it's
wild.
A beautiful thing.
Wild. I want to show
you. Just watch it if you're taking the bus, the water bus.
Why?
Because there's a lot of pickpockets in okay. in Venice.
I'll ask for a gondola. So I wanted to show you an app that I know is brand new. Maybe you hadn't heard about. This is an iOS app. It's great on the iPad. It's called Flightboard. And now there are, of course, lots of flight tracker apps. I use I'm a big fan of TripIt, and TripIt will let you know if your flight's delayed or so forth.
I'm a big fan of TripIt.
Isn't TripIt great? I actually pay for the pro version because it's so great. But this is fun. You pick the airport, and this is the arrival or departure board at the airport exactly as it shows up when you arrive. So you can pull it up on your iPad, sort by destination, flight, gate, departure time, and it'll show you the status. So you'll know.
I love it.
Yeah, isn't that cool? Kind of a hard way to find that out. There are lots of other very cool ways to do that. Do you use a website in particular, Johnny, to check on your flights? Is there any way you do that?
Well, you know, I use a bunch of them. But So before I leave, I always check weather. I also check fly.faa.gov, which is the government's Flight Command Center.
Federal Aviation Administration.
Yep. So this, and it will show you airports are being delayed or not.
Oh,
and
this also, shows you all the delays. So here, for instance, SFO, delayed due to wind. Departure is subject to ground delay program. So you can see immediately Newark Airport also is a red due to weather or wind. So you, this is good. fly.faa.gov.
But you can't just rely on that. So also you want to sign up to the airport's Twitter stream. So, and most airports do have Twitter streams, and actually I have a list for that. I know last week we talked about my airline list. I also have an airport list on Twitter, which is handy. Because, you know, especially if you're going to one destination a lot or flying out of certain airports, sign up for their Twitter. Also, you have to sign up for the airline that you're flying and sign up to their status updates.
This is great. And I see you also subscribe to Flight Advisor, which is Twitter's becoming a really great communication medium, isn't it? Look at this.
For sure. Even if you don't want to put out your information, it's just a great way to get information.
Right, right.
Especially travel information. And again, you know, if there's a delay or something, you can also tweet the airline. And American Airlines actually is one of the best at responding right away. And Delta actually has a whole team.
Wait, you mean you send them a tweet? You say, at America Airlines, what the heck's going on? Am I late?
Yeah.
And they'll respond?
They'll respond. Go test it right now. Today's Saturday, but I still think they'll respond right away.
Their Twitter handle is American Air. But, you know, the best thing to do is to go to twitter.com/JohnnyJet. People ask me, why would I use Twitter? And I agree with you, Johnny. You don't necessarily want to tweet. Johnny and I tweet because, you know, we want to help our fans and so forth. But even if you don't want to tweet, by following these people, you're getting this communication stream. And then you can, if you're late, say, hey, American Airlines, I'm late. What should I do? Yeah. Wow, that's awesome. So if you go to twitter.com/JohnnyJet, he has his lists, and then you can subscribe to the list. So I've subscribed now to the airlines list. I've subscribed to the cruises list, to the airports list, all city alerts list. I got it all now, Johnny. You're the king. You're the king. This is it. That's fantastic.
But what important thing, by the way, is when you're if you're delayed in the airport, you know, instead of just waiting a line, jump on the phone right away with the airline. So program your phone with the airline's phone number. I actually created a website called airlinenumbers.com. It has all the toll numbers throughout the world for every airline. But it's very important that, you know, instead of wasting time in a long line, try to get rebooked on another flight, get on the phone while you're standing in line. Because usually the person on the phone can help you.
All those other schmoes who were at the airport who heard the announcement, I'm sorry, your flight has been canceled due to weather, run over to the counter, and there's 100 people in line. You're just going, I'd like another flight.
Or pass to the airline club. If you're a member, better. If not, you can buy a day pass for $50. Usually walk up, and guys, there won't be a long line, and these guys have a lot of pull in there.
So if you're going over the river and through the woods for the holidays, and I know Thanksgiving's probably the busiest airline day, but I have to think the days before Christmas.
Christmas is very busy.
Yeah,
especially today and yesterday was ridiculously busy.
Johnny, great to talk to you. JohnnyJet.com for all of this information. Enjoy your day in Delray. Bye-bye.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas, Johnny. That's great stuff. Take care.
Let you drop
so very
in.
Nice.
I'll hold your hands. They're just like
my
ice.
Mother will start to.
I think this actually is my favorite Christmas song.
And father will be pacing.
I wonder why.
So really, I'd better.
Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888. Ask Leo. Sorry about the audio quality on Johnny. He was via Skype from a hotel room. Sometimes Skype Wi-Fi is not great, but we will put in the show notes all the links to the various sites he recommended for travel during the holiday season, especially when there's lots of weather delays and so forth. A couple of really useful tips in that one. Johnny Jet will be back next week with more for you, more tips for you. Melissa in Menifee, California. You're next. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Melissa.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. Welcome. Happy holidays.
Thank you for taking my call. Thank you.
Thanks.
I just recently purchased a Panasonic 3D smart TV.
Me too.
And I would like to buy my husband a keyboard to go with it, but I was told that I can only buy Panasonic for that TV, and I was wondering if that's true.
A keyboard so he could type?
Yeah, go online, because it's a smart TV, so he can go pull up a computer, you know, his screen, and surf the web straight on TV. So I would like him to be able to use that. Since it is,
that's interesting.
TV, but.
You know, it's funny. I have a Viera, and they do offer a keyboard for it, but I hadn't even really thought about that. So let me look and see.
I called into a couple of electronic places, and they were telling me that they didn't carry Panasonic. I guess you had to purchase it through Panasonic, which is funny because I bought the TV through the electronic place I was calling, but
right, yeah, we don't sell that. Well, Panasonic themselves recommends something from Logitech, which is actually great.
Okay.
It's $88. It's called the DINOVO, the DeNovo Mini Keyboard, and Panasonic does recommend this, so I know it will work with your Viera. They list it in, under the Viera. They list it as Viera Connect Apps or Viera Connect Hardware. And they have some, it's interesting, I didn't know this, they have game controllers, they have all sorts of stuff that works with it. Now you've got me interested, I'm going to have to try this. Of course, there's a camera.
Well, it's a whole new thing.
Yeah, very interesting. So I have tried, however, this Logitech DeNovo. It's very cool, it's got a little cover for it. It's small, so it won't take up a lot of space on your coffee table, and it has a built-in trackpad, so he doesn't have to have a separate mouse for it.
Perfect.
Yeah.
That's exactly what we need.
Yeah.
Then.
$88. That's about
so
right. Yeah, you're welcome. I appreciate the call.
All right, have a good Christmas.
Yeah, you actually inspired me. I'm going to go out and get one myself. I had no idea. I had no idea. Let's see. Oh, did we I forgot to go back to Bill from Calgary. Let's go back to Bill. Hi Bill, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Apologies. You're very you're a patient guy. Yeah, welcome.
Well, we're patient up here. It's really cool outside up here, I'll tell you.
I'll tell you, winter in Calgary. Woo! Has it snowed up there yet?
Oh, it's really cold. It's -21 Celsius today.
What?
Yeah.
Oh.
Anyway, but I called you about phones, Leo.
Okay.
I'm about upgrade to a smartphone, and there's a million deals out there what kind of smartphone I should get.
Oh, yeah.
The Windows 8, the Android, or the Apple phone.
Those are your three big choices. Now, because you're Canadian, you probably should look at BlackBerry, too.
Oh, is that right?
No. BlackBerry announced the RIM, which is out of Ontario, announced their quarterly earnings this week. And they said they'd lost 1 million users, the first huge loss ever in the history of BlackBerry. And I think we will watch with interest. I don't know if it's over yet, because BlackBerry 10, the next version of the operating system, is reputedly very, very good. But it's not out yet. So for now, you're right. The choices are Windows Phone, Android Phone, or iOS. Do you use a computer, Bill?
Oh, yeah. I'm computer savvy, and I'm on really Windows operating system.
Okay, so you're a Windows guy, yeah. And now, of course, all three work fine with Windows. You wouldn't have much of a business if you didn't work with Windows. I think for your first smartphone, though, I would absolutely look at a Windows phone. There's two I recommend. The Lumia 920, that's a Nokia phone. I'm not sure who offers that. Probably, I would guess all of it's available at Rogers and Telus and Bell. But if not the Lumia 920, the negative on the 920 is a little heavy and a little thick, but it has a very good camera, and it has a nice suite of Nokia apps, including the very, very good Nokia Maps. But the competitor to it, which I think is thinner and maybe marginally better, is the HTC 8X. Those are your
my
two.
Kids have those.
Yeah. Well, okay. That's an even better reason to get it, because then you can call your kids and say, "Hey, how do you turn this on, or how do you turn that off?" It's nice to have somebody who is using it at the same time as you are to give you a hand.
They're half of them have got Apple equipment and half of them have got HTC equipment.
Well, now the reason, now I have to say it's interesting. I'm seeing, you know, Apple's stock price has tumbled over the last 2 weeks, and I think it's mostly because of the perception that Apple no longer owns the market. iPhone owned the market for 4 years out of from 2007 on. Yeah. But the competition has gotten very strong, and Apple has not innovated particularly with the iPhone. They've kind of rested on their laurels the last couple of years. Now, the advantage the iPhone has is a great app ecosystem. There's more than 250,000 applications available for the iPhone, some very, very nice stuff. It has an excellent camera. They're beautifully made. I think they're very attractive looking phones, and they're very easy to use. They're not hard to use. The Windows Phone 8 is probably the easiest, then the iPhone. The geeks in the world seem to like Android. I'm a geek, so I use an Android phone because it's more customizable. You can mess around with it more. You can get in trouble with it more too. In fact, the Samsung just announced that there's a big security flaw in the Galaxy S3 and the Galaxy Notes, and so you can get in more trouble on a Android phone because you can download apps from bad sources and stuff. So for your first smartphone, I think your choice is absolutely iPhone or a Windows phone. And since you're a Windows user, I would take a look at Windows phone.
Okay, Leo, well, that's great. Leo, before I leave, you should come up here in July sometime.
Yeah, I'll come for the Stampede.
Yeah, you'll take some good pictures up here.
I would love to. You know what? That's a deal. I'll come up. Stampede's in July.
Well, it's still the first 10 days in July in that area. But If you want to come, you just get on the internet and go to the Stampede, and they'll look after you.
I would love to do that, Bill. Have you grown your whole life in Calgary? You're a native?
Well, I was born and raised in Alberta, yeah.
So the weather is nothing to you. This is not 31 below, nothing to you.
It's cold, Leo. Anyway, thanks a lot, Leo.
Thank you, Bill.
Bye-bye.
Take care. I really appreciate it. We have lots of wonderful fans up in Canada because I think Bill was about to mention, I used to do a TV show up there for 4 years out of Toronto, then Vancouver. And I'm an honorary Canadian. But I'm not such an honorary Canadian that I could take that. When a native of Alberta says it's cold, you know it's cold. Ooh, baby. Alex in North Hollywood, California, very patient fella. Thank you for holding on. I have a new call screening program, Alex, that tells me how long you've been waiting. I wish I didn't know this, but thank you for your patience.
It's not a big deal. Actually, this is actually my second time talking to you.
So you're used to it.
Yeah. Thanks so much for picking up my call.
My pleasure.
Thanks so much. The reason for my question, actually, for my call is, I play less music with a band, and they just implemented a Mac Mini to play instruments on stage. And obviously, Mac Mini doesn't have a screen. I have an iPad.
Hang on, because we got to take a break for news. I got to put you on hold again. We will be right back, and I'll help you with that. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Well, a good day to you, Leo Laporte here, the Tech Guy, Hour 3 of the Tech Guy Show, as we talk about computers and the internet and cell phones, home theater, all that jazz. My phone number, 8888-ASK-LEO, 8888-ASK-LEO, that's 888-827-5536, toll free from anywhere in the U.S., outside the U.S., you can Skype in. You can also find our webpage, techguylabs.com. That's on the web. And there you'll find a link to our chat room, another way to communicate, techguylabs.com. And, I'd love to hear from you. We could talk about your next computer, your next technology, help you with anything that's on your mind. I'd love to give you a hand. We were talking, and unfortunately, we ran out of time, but I'm going to put him back on with Alex in North Hollywood. He's a musician. They make music now with an iPad Mini. I'm sorry, a Mac Mini. What are they using? Logic or something like that? To play the samples?
We actually use Cubase.
Cubase, okay. So they're using some software that's playing back a track.
Well, actually, more of an instrument. I mean, fundamentally, what I'm trying to do is the Mac Mini doesn't have a screen. I have an extra iPad, and I should have an old base station Extreme. When I go and play, you know, obviously I can't take an entire monitor with me, so it's easier for me to take an iPad. And all what I would need is actually somehow to be able to use the iPad as the mouse cursor to double-click and launch the application.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah, and that's pretty straightforward. What you need is, and I think you know this, is a VNC server running on your Mac. Your Mac has that actually built in, so you don't have to get any special software. And then you need a VNC client on your iPad that would essentially let you see the Mac screen on the iPad and control it, pop up a keyboard when you need a keyboard, things
exactly,
like that.
Yeah.
There is one called Mocha, M-O-C-H-A, V-N-C. There's a free version and a paid version, and that works quite well. There are apps for some of the other companies, like our sponsor, I should mention, Go to My PC, that are paid. Log Me In is another one that are paid. But this Mocha V-N-C Lite is free and would at least let you try it. Before you make sure that for instance, there might be some sluggishness that might bug you a little bit, things like that. But at least you'd be able to try before you buy.
Got it. And how reliable is this when it's, when it's on? In other words,
well, the real issue is going to be the venue, because the way you're going to connect to the iPad is over Wi-Fi.
That's taking my base station Extreme all the time. So I'm creating kind of a closed network.
Perfect.
Yeah, this way, sometimes if we play outdoors or indoors or wherever we are,
perfect.
I don't have to worry about having some kind of a Wi-Fi connection with my Extreme. I can set up a kind of more of a closed network. I always have a connection between them.
Should work perfectly then.
Okay, perfect.
Yeah, I think that's. I think Mocha is probably the best simple choice for that. There are quite a few. Log Me In, somebody's recommending Splash Top. Let me see. It looks like Beatmaster says there's a program that can control Cubase via MIDI as well. So that might be another way to do it. But it sounds like there is a number of ways to do exactly what you want to do.
Well, I have that too. I mean, the only thing that I need this for is just to launch the application.
I got it.
That's all.
You need to see the desktop. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think Mocha would be plenty for you.
Got it. Perfect.
Thanks, Alan. Appreciate the call. Thanks for your patience. Robert is trucking in Arizona. Robert, you're next. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
How you doing, Leo?
I'm well, Robert. How are you?
Just going down the road, watching all the nuts.
Yeah, this must be a tough time of year to drive.
Yeah, some of these people I'm watching today, I just watched a guy almost take out another car.
You must see it all. I got to say, sitting up there looking down on the world, you got to have a great view of crazy drivers.
There's a question I do have for you other than what I
sure.
Stays off to ask you. I want to mount a camera on my dash because I've been trying to figure out how to start a website where just contract with, you know, other drivers and take webcam of idiots out there.
Wouldn't that? I'll tell you, I've seen tumble logs and stuff where they use stills of idiot. I wish I could remember. There are a couple of websites where they're just stills of stupid people doing stupid things. But it'd be great to have.
I'd like to have a little dash camera and, you know, contract with, you know, fellow drivers and say, hey, I'll put a camera in your truck. I'll maintain the thing. Just let me get the live feed off of it.
You know, there's, of course, and I've seen this, there's a security device, a lot of cabs have these now, that just are constantly recording, but if you hit a button or if you hit a car, it saves the last 30 seconds out. So what you'd want is a camera that's always recording, but that the driver could say, whoa, you got to see that, hit a button, and it would send you over the 30-second video, because that's all you really need.
Anyways, It's real busy out here on the road.
I bet it is. Well, drive safely, please.
The question I have for you is actually for a friend of mine. Our company allows us to transmit our bill of lading and things like that directly to the company in Nebraska. And as long as, you know, they work with, like, PCs, things like that, and as long as you have internet connection, you can transmit it.
Right.
By way of using a portable scanner. Well, he doesn't have a PC, but he has a Galaxy 2 tablet.
Well, that has a pretty good camera on the back of it. And so he could very likely take a picture that would be just as good as the scan he would be sending. I'm certainly legible. I know my bank and many banks let you use your smartphone to take pictures of checks, and they count that as a check. That's a deposit. So it's got to be, if it's good enough to be able to read a check, it should be good enough to read a bill of lading. So I don't think you even have to tell him that you didn't scan it. Yeah, just take a picture.
Okay, but is there a possible way to hook a, like, one of those, the portable document scanners to a Galaxy 2? Is there a possible way, or?
That's a good question. I don't think so.
We work with the company TripTac, and so
my guess, Robert, is that there is not. Because you'd need software on the Android device that understood scanners, and you'd need a way to hook up the scanner to the device. It doesn't have a – does the Galaxy have a USB port on it? I don't think it does. It has a charging point, but it doesn't have a charging port. Right. I don't think there's a way to hook the scanner up to it. But, you know, to be honest, I don't think you have a problem, because I think the camera – on that thing is good enough, it's high quality enough, it'd be as good as a scan. So I would give that a try. And then there's a number of programs you can get on Android. I mean, you can just take a picture of it, and I would try it and see if they'll take it. But then there are a number of programs as well that are specialized in, like, crisping it up and so forth. Now, Sophia in our chat room says you can get a USB plug for the Galaxy. I'm not sure how that would work. So just use the camera. I think that's the best. Why struggle? Just use the camera. Mark in Los Angeles, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Mark. Hey, Mark, welcome.
Yes, Leo.
What can I do for you? How you doing?
Yeah. Okay, I just tried to install ESET, and I get an error message.
Ah, what is the error message?
It just says error 2878. That doesn't tell me anything.
Yeah, I mean, I don't, off the top of my head, I don't know. Let me see if I can find out. If not, just send me an email, and I can forward you to ESET support. 2878, let me see if I can find out. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888-ASK-LEO. All right. Well, let me give you a couple answers to previous calls for the truck driver who was looking for a scanner so they could scan bills of lading and send them off to the company. As I mentioned, you know, he wanted to use a Galaxy Note tablet to do that. I mentioned the camera on the tablet probably be adequate, but the chat room has pointed me to a little program, or actually a piece of hardware called the Doxie, D-O-X-I-E, getdoxie.com. It's a $150 scanner, very small, compact scanner that scans not to a computer, but to an SD card. Ah. So you could scan in your stuff and then pop the SD card and put that in the tablet. Ah. So that'd be a good way to do it. And for our previous caller who was getting error 2878 when trying to install the ESET antivirus, ESET, NOD32, like other antiviruses, does not like to install on top of existing antiviruses. There are a lot of good reasons for that. They tend to conflict. Often one antivirus will see the other as a virus, things like that. So that is generally the generic message that you'd get from ESET's NOD32 if there's another antivirus on the system. So they have some suggestions in their knowledge base, a couple of things to go through. Your probably best bet would be, and we'll put this in the show notes, to go to the ESET knowledge base and read the solution ID SOLN2878. That's specifically about that error message and gives you some step-by-step choices, things you can do to solve that, to get around it. But in general, you get that because Norton or some other antivirus is installed, and you need to uninstall those. It's pretty much always the case that when you're uninstalling Norton or McAfee, the two most popular antiviruses, almost everybody gets them when they buy a Windows system, because these companies very aggressively market to Windows machine manufacturers and say, hey, please put our antivirus on there as trialware, and we'll give you some money. So you almost always get a trial version of McAfee or Norton when you buy a new computer. The problem is that it's hard to remove those. It takes a little extra effort. And as kind of testament to that fact, both Norton, this company Symantec, and McAfee offer special standalone uninstall programs that do a little bit better than just uninstalling the normal way. So if you do have a McAfee or Norton installed on your system, you want to get rid of them, install something else, whether it's ESET or anything else, you can Google Norton uninstaller or McAfee uninstaller, and go to the Symantec site or the McAfee site that you find in that search, and get those uninstallers. They do a better job. They're frankly much better job than the, you'd think they'd build that in. I don't know why they don't. Mark in Southern California, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Mark.
Yeah, hi.
Welcome to the show. What can I do for you?
I've got a question. I believe I've got a virus, spyware or whatever it is. I'm not quite sure, but at certain times of the day, I start up AOL and my cursor goes crazy. If I go to AOL through Internet Explorer, it's fine. But the basic question was
that, by the way, that may just be a bug in the America Online software. The first thing to do if you suspect a virus is to run some antivirus software to see if it finds a virus.
Okay. Well, I've got McAfee, and it never finds anything.
My favorite. you know, there's a couple other things you can do that Microsoft distributes with Windows Update. Are you running Windows XP?
Yeah.
Yeah. With Windows Update, they distribute a program called their malicious software removal tool. You have that on your system probably. If you press Windows R to get the run box, or you'll select the run command from the start menu if it's there, and type MRT and hit return. When you run the malicious software removal tool in a thorough scan, that often is a good way to see if there's anything on there. If you've got McAfee, certainly update it and make sure that you've got it updated. But you know, in my opinion, if you think you've got a virus, it's probably worth trying to fix it. The problem is that fixing it is such a pain that you want to make sure that you're not doing it unnecessarily. So,
is it possible to do a system restore far enough back to where it gets away from that?
It almost never works because virus authors try to prevent you from doing that. There's a couple of tricks they use. They'll delete all the restore points. If you try to do a restore and there's no restore points, hey, that's another sign you might have a piece of malware on there. Another thing that they often do is they inject themselves into the restore point. So you run a restore and you're not getting rid of anything. You're actually restoring the virus. And there are other tricks they use to kind of prevent you from fixing it. It's worth a try. Just because your mouse jumps around with one program does not necessarily mean that you have malware. It just could be something wrong with the AOL software. But if you really, you know, if you'd run some scans and there's online scans too, antivirus.com. ESET has its own online scan at ESET.com. If you've run those online scans, run a bunch of them. If you update McAfee, run a scan, run the malicious software removal tool, run a thorough scan. Do some of the online antiviruses, antivirus.com. It's called House Call. That's the Trend Micro, Trend PC, Cylon program, ESETs, online scanner. If all of those come up negative, in other words, no virus, then I wouldn't worry about it. There's probably something wrong with AOL. If they say, yeah, you got a bug, System Restore is not going to do the job. You really, I hate to tell you this, but this is why you want to double check to make sure you got a bad guy on there. Once you get a bad guy on there, there really is only one way. You got to nuke the thing. You got to start over. You got to erase the hard drive, reinstall Windows from a known good source. I've gone through this before, and we probably should have an article on our website about what to do. it's my opinion that just you cannot guarantee that your system's clean, even if you run a disinfector. And if you take it to the shop, a lot of times these guys will run Malwarebytes or some other disinfector tool and say, "Yeah, you're all good. You're clean," and you're not. And that's the problem. Is nowadays bad guys don't want you to get rid of them. They obscure themselves. They hide themselves in code. They really try to keep you from disinfecting, and they also try to hide stuff on there so that even if you do quote disinfect end quote, they're still there. Steve's in Portland, Oregon. Hi, Steve. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hello, Leo.
Hello, Steve.
Okay, I'm finally going to my every 5 years upgrade. I've just ordered a new laptop with Windows 7.
Interesting. You decided not to get 8. You decided to go with 7.
Yeah, and the reason is, I think, because Microsoft's running that Windows 8 $14 upgrade or something.
Right. So you have the choice.
But what I want to do when I get it, and I didn't know, I want to immediately go to a solid-state drive, and I'm wondering if I should make an image of that before I start the laptop for the very first time, or what software is needed to do that.
So you're going to buy a laptop and then replace the drive before you use it?
Well, that was the question. If I do it before I use it, or do I actually load the Windows 7 and then make the image copy, or...
The easiest thing would be to buy the system with a SSD drive installed. But let's say you don't want to do that for some reason. I'll talk about what you should do to back it up when we return. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. We were talking about getting a new computer and putting an SSD in after you get it. And I was thinking about it, and there are reasons you might want to do that. For instance, it's not unusual for companies to overcharge for new technology like solid-state drives. So perhaps you feel you can get an SSD drive that's faster, bigger, better in every way for less money. So maybe you'd order the computer with a normal drive in it and then replace the normal drive with an SSD. There's a second advantage to that. The drive that the computer came with is, you know, kind of in its pristine state. If you pop it out now, you got a backup. Anything goes wrong with the SSD, you just take it out, put the old drive in, and you're back to ground zero, stage one of that computer. But his question was good. It was, when do you do the swap? And the answer will depend a little bit on how the computer was configured by the manufacturer. Most computers today don't come with media at all. You know, the ideal, in the good old days when I was a young man, and this would certainly be the ideal, is for a computer to come with a pure vanilla Microsoft Windows disk. You know, there's your Windows 7 disk, your install disk. Beautiful. Microsoft hologram on it and everything. That is gold. Because you can use that at any time to put it on a new drive or whatever. That's going to give you a working computer. But Microsoft doesn't want people to do that because, of course, Microsoft doesn't say that's pure gold. They say that's pure piracy. You're going to give that to your friends. And even though Microsoft has not one but two different ways of preventing your friends from using that disk, they still don't want to give you the disk. And that's really, you know, kind of the third form of copy protection. They are so paranoid about people stealing Windows that they don't want you to have a disk. And so they actually charge less to the manufacturer, to Dell or Lenovo or HP, if they don't put a disk in. Windows costs less if you don't ship it with a disk. Oh, that's good. That's nice. So most of the time, you're not going to get a Windows disk or even recovery disks. You're just going to get a computer. No CDs, no DVDs, just a computer. And if this is the case, then on that drive is critical stuff. Stuff you need, the recovery partition and so forth. My suggestion would be that probably is the time to clone that drive. If you can, get a boot disk with cloning software on it. Anybody who makes hard drives will offer cloning software. You can buy cloning software. Software that will do a bit-for-bit copy of that shipping hard drive onto your new SSD. And then pull the old hard drive, put in the SSD, and start it up for the first time. In other words, copy it before you start it. Because that, again, gives you this ability to, if the SSD dies at some point, the new hard drive dies at some point, you put in the old one, turn it on, and it's as if you just got home from the store. And one of the things that usually happens at the very at the first boot is the company says, okay, good, you're going to make your recovery discs now. Get some blank discs, and we'll walk you through the process. So if you are in that boat, and that 99% of people buying new computers will be in that boat, where they don't have any discs, they're expected to make discs on first boot, I would say clone the drive and swap before you do anything. If you have a Windows disk, then it doesn't even matter. You don't even have to clone the drive. Just pop that old drive out, put the new drive in, run the Windows installer, and you're good. I think that's probably the best thing. There's no reason to run the installer, go through any of the process before you make the clone. Why not make a clone of the pristine, driven snow with no footprints upon it at all? The day it came home from the factory. Now, that doesn't mean you don't want to make subsequent images. You might want to use disk imaging software after, for instance, you boot it, you recover it, you know, make the recovery disks, you install the software you want, you update. That's important. You want to run that Windows update because no matter how new that computer is, it's almost guaranteed that Windows will be a little bit out of date. You want to get those updates on there to protect yourself. Get it to the point where you love how it's working. It's got everything on it. You got rid of all the test software that you don't want, all the trial versions. You uninstalled it. You cleaned up the desktop, put the desktop wallpaper you want on. You know, all the customizations people do when they get their new computer. And you got it perfect. Before you go any further, before you start surfing the net or risk getting any infections on there or junking it up, that's when you also want to make a clone, a second clone, an image of that, so that you can very quickly get back to that. A lot of software that will do that. EASEUS, EASEUS.com has a very good program that will do that. There are a lot of different things. Now, somebody, Web1605, says an interesting thing. He says, you might want to turn the machine on first to see if it works. What if it doesn't work? I think you could assume it's going to work. And if it doesn't, you swap the drive out and bring it back. But that's a reasonable point. You might want to turn it on, make sure it works first. Not a bad idea. Lori is in San Diego. She's our next caller. Hi, Lori. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi, Leo. This is Lori, and my husband and I are looking at TVs between 70 and 75 inch.
Ooh, aren't you in luck? Aren't you lucky?
I know. It's kind of fun.
Yeah. So you want to, do you have any thing you want to tell me that you want, you're looking for? Do you have anything particular you're trying to get?
Well, we were pretty amazed with the 75-inch Samsung.
Yeah, they're gorgeous.
But the price tag was a little high.
Well, 75 is going to be the more expensive. You're 60 and below, those are kind of mainstream. But when you get to 65, 70, and 75, you're talking about the largest TVs they make in many cases. And so those are going to be a little bit premium priced. If price is an object, then, you might see some sticker shock. My personal favorite, and I'm going to have to see, I just bought a large screen Panasonic Viera plasma. And it's most agree the Vieras are the best TVs out there right now. I don't know, though, if they go to mine was 65. I'm not sure what the largest one is.
That's our research has shown us that 65 is the largest.
Yeah.
But the plasma is the best picture.
It is absolutely a stunning picture, and I'm not alone in my opinion. Pretty much all the reviewers agree that the top-of-the-line Viera is the best, currently the best TV made. Now, Sharp does make an LCD, the Elite. But now we're talking a lot of money. So that may not be a good choice for you. And I don't know.
And that's the same.
Well, the Sharp Elite goes to 70 inches. It's LCD. Okay. It is gorgeous. It's got better black levels even than the VT50, the Viera I was talking about. They bought the Elite line from Kuro. So these are really expensive, however, I mean, really good looking, however, really expensive TVs. CNET called them overpriced even. But they're LCDs. I think, I think the VT50, the Panasonic Viera VT50, that's the one I bought, and it's one most people recommend. It's just not quite as big as you'd like. So I'm not sure what to recommend in a larger size. Plasmas tend not to, I don't know if any plasmas, that, maybe the chat room does, that go to that 75 inches. The Samsung you're looking at is LCD?
It's a smart TV and it's LCD and it has a movie camera. It's $9,000.
Yeah, that's too much. That's too much.
That's a little more than what we need.
Yeah, no. Well, that's crazy. That's crazy.
Question. We were wondering, we've heard stories that plasmas may wear out within 5 years.
That's old news. In the early days, plasmas did. Because plasma is a gas-charged cell, and they were leaking, and they would wear. I don't think they wear out any faster than anything else. I wouldn't worry about that. There's no burn-in problem either, and they really do give you the best image. Leo Laporte, Theater Car. Interesting question. What if you want a really big TV, but you don't want to pay a really big price tag? And I have to say, I have not been able. I'm looking around, and I'm looking for a 70 or 70-inch TV, 75-inch TV for our last caller. And the one she was looking at, the Samsung, $10,000 list. I think if you're going bigger than 65, you probably should start looking at projectors. Then you can go 80, 90, 100. I have a 110-inch screen and a projector, and we're talking well below 10 grand for something like that, and it'll look good. But I think if you really want the best quality picture, I just got to point you. In fact, we'll put a link in the show notes to this article from CNET. There's a retailer in the Northeast called Value Electronics that does this every year. They've been doing it for about 10 years, I think. Where they take the best TVs, they take an objective panel of judges who are in the industry, and they rate them. And they do this every year. They just did their 2012 shootout. And they looked at that, you know, Samsung, the Sharp Elite that I mentioned. They looked at Panasonic. And I have to say, the 65-inch VT50 from Panasonic won that shootout handily. Handily. The only TV that even came close was that very expensive Sharp Elite, which is 60 inches. I would say look at the Panasonic Viera. Try to see if you can survive at a 65 inches. If you really have to go 70 or 75, it gets very expensive, and I'm not sure why. I guess those panels are just expensive to produce. Plasma doesn't go that big. They'll be LCD. I don't think you'll get an image quality as good as you're expecting for the amount of money you're paying for the size. So if that's important, get a good projector instead of getting a DirecTV TV. Hey, he's here, Dick DiBartolo, Mad Magazine's maddest writer and our gadget expert, the Gizwiz, we call him. Dicky D joins us every week at this time with a gadget review. Hi, Dick.
Leo, how you doing?
Very well. Happy holidays. You got that? Looks like Disneyland's all decorated.
Oh, Disneyland is, yes. Not as good, not as much crap on the screen as you have.
I got tinsel.
I got a little LED. I had this mounted on the mic, but there's so much light in here, you can't see it changing colors.
Yeah.
But you know what, Leo? While you were away and I was with Scott, Vizio just introduced a 70-inch. Now, you know, they're kind of budget TVs. So that comes in at $2,000.
Oh, I can't imagine that's a very good TV, but okay.
Yeah, but you know what? It is amazing. Their 60-inch is $1,000, and the 70-inch is $2,000.
Yeah, it just shows you when you get that big.
Yeah,
my
absolutely.
Opinion, get a good 65-inch, the VT50 from Panasonic, clearly the leader there. It's about $3,000, and you're going to get a beautiful. It's what I have, and I love it. You're going to get a beautiful TV, and many, many people agree. That's the best. Plasma is going to give you the best picture. It's the best TV out there.
Yeah, I had the 100-inch here, but the 30 inches in the street, the city complained about.
Your apartment's just not that big.
Not that big.
Yeah. What do you got for us today?
Something really small. It's called Penzen, and it's from Quirky. We talked about it on the Gizwiz, and I wanted to mention it on radio because we haven't mentioned Quirky in many, many months.
Quirky's interesting. So these are guys. In fact, we get calls all the time from people say, I have a brilliant gadget idea. I would like to manufacture it. Help me. And I know you and I both have in the past been very negative about that. You know, just, boy, you get ready. You're going to spend a lot of money, you know, getting it to market. Then you got to get distribution. It's tough. Quirky is the
budget way to do it.
They've reinvented this. And some people are making a lot of money on Quirky.
Exactly. I don't know how much the Pen Zen guy's making, but we did Pivot Power, and that guy made like $80,000 or $90,000. That was the power strip that bent. So if two transformer plugs wouldn't fit next to each other, you just bend the power strip like into a circle, and then every single plug could take a big transformer. So Pen Zen is a little bamboo pencil box, but instead of just throwing the pencils in, it has like hundreds of little rubber fingers. So whatever you stick in, it stands straight up in the air. They've put magnets behind the bamboo so that your paper clips and anything else that's metallic can click onto the side of Pen Zen. It sells for $19.99. But as you said, if you want to, if you have an idea for an invention, you can register it there for $10. Then they have people who join Quirky vote on it. You have to get a certain number of votes. Then people can say, I like it, but I think this should be done to it.
Ah.
Everybody whose suggestion gets used also gets part of the profit. So it's a fun place to find gadgets like the Pen Zen.
This is kind of cool. It was invented by Edwin van de Bosport. A lot of these guys are from Holland for some reason. It's been out for a month. Well, my development duration was a month. It's been in stores for 3 months, 157 days. He has sold 4,000 of them. He's made $7,600. And that's the exact opposite of what most inventors end up spending hundreds of thousands of dollars to get into the store.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
So this is a real success story.
Yeah. I remember hearing from the Better Business Bureau that all those companies where we're going to sell your invention, about 3% of the people who signed up made more money than they paid the company.
Yeah. So 97% lost money.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
That's a good thing to remember. Quirky is like Kickstarter and Kiva and all these new ideas, new ways of doing things that the internet enables. And it's just transformed everything. And I think it's just I don't know these guys. I only know the success stories, but they seem to be quite a few.
No, they're looking at our USB toilet paper dispenser.
I have high hopes for that. Now, it does require you to bring a laptop or a desktop to the bathroom. But I think, you know, the fact that you're getting exactly the right amount of toilet paper dispensed each and every time makes that okay. You know, the fact that...
Yeah, and as you pull the sheets, it charges your iPod. It's just a win-win. Gadget.
Actually, there's an interesting story about that. Did you see the Kickstarter project? I think we talked about it. Was it called Pop? The idea was it was a charger, kind of the new beautiful charger for iPhones, iPads, and all of that. And I'll show you a picture of it. Maybe you'll remember it. It looked like it was kind of an inverted. It was a clever idea, kind of a canister, maybe a flower container, but it had cables coming out that would let you charge several cell phones and tablets at once.
Yeah.
They made $139,000 on Kickstarter to make it, and then Apple said, "Oh, hey, by the way, you can't use the Lightning connector." That was it. They said, "Okay, we're giving everybody's money back." And then the good news: there's a happy ending to this.
Yes,
Apple changed its mind.
I think
people got mad at them and said, "What are you talking about? These guys had this great Kickstarter project, and it's a really, a lot of people put money in." And so Apple said, "Okay."
Social media.
So they've decided that that Pop can go ahead. Apple will now allow its Lightning adapter to coexist with a 30-pin adapter in the same accessory. That was the problem. It did both 30-pin and Lightning, and Apple didn't want that, I guess.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So that's good, huh? Apple changed their tune. Pop is a success. I'm going to order one because I think it's a great idea.
Very good.
Gizwiz.biz, you know what that is?
Yeah.
Besides the lyrics to a very famous song from the 30s, Oh, what a giz whiz biz he is. It's also Dick's website. And if you go to gizwiz.biz, I do encourage you, you'll find all the details about the products Dick talks about on this show and on our gadget show, the Giz Whiz. But you'll also find the What the Heck Is It game, a chance to win an autographed copy of Mad. Dick, you're the one that autographs it, right?
Yeah, I am.
I'm just checking. Yeah. You'll be playing for the February issue of Mad Magazine, the 20 Dumbest People, Events, and Things of 2012. And there were many to choose from. But all you have to do is figure out what this elf bow and arrow really is. By the way, 12 Mad Magazines for the right answer, 24 for the wrong answer. So, you know, use your conscience as a guide. Dick, thanks so much.
Yes, sir.
Well, that's it for the Tech Guy show for today. I'm Leo Laporte. Thank you so much for joining us. Don't forget, the Tech Guy is just the tip of the iceberg. We do nearly 30 shows now on the Twit Netcast Network, and you'll find them all at twit.tv. We talk about Windows on Windows Weekly, Macintosh on MacBreak Weekly, iPad on iPad Today. You get your daily dose of tech news from Tech News Today and our weekly roundtable show, This Week in Tech. It's all at twit.tv. And I'll be back next time with another great Tech Guy podcast. Thanks for joining me. See you next time.